It's well past the dinner hour, but still light by the time we return from hiking the yak in celebration of the solstice. We could do with food and drinks of certain descriptions, and the Dirty Shame Saloon is a good place for such things. Better at least than it sounds. A low hulking ceiling inside. The entire wall behind the bar papered in folding money, bills pasted up by travelers with inscriptions of where they came from, the promises of their return, and the ready money to buy drinks when they do. We can still smell the sun on our skin. The sun is still holding outside, for that matter, shows no sign of tiring, and we're practically drunk on it by now, happy enough to sit up at the bar amid the gabble of conversation. A couple of fellows are getting pleasantly stinko a few stools down, arm wrestling for drinks and cigars. The bartender, a woman whose name is Willie, smokes cigarettes as long as a wand, talks to us in a howl of a voice, dishes the lowdown on what's been happening lately. Everybody knows everybody. They ask us where we're from, and we tell them, even the name of the place. It's okay. We're among friends. We discuss this and that and nothing in particular, trading horror stories about the respective winters we endured. And so it goes. It's a good deal later when another couple enters the bar. Everything stops for a beat, the chemistry of the room changing, if only for a flicker. And it's clear that these folks aren't locals either. They sit at the table behind us, and the questions go out about where they're from. Massachusetts, they say. Boston. A call carries down the bar to a fellow we had talked to earlier. He looks like the very definition of mountain man, a waterfall of a beard, a build stout enough that he could have been hewn from the red cedar we hiked through this morning. It turns out he's from Beantown, too. It's beautiful here, one of the couple tells him. And they all agree that it is. What do you do here? The other one wants to know. And Mountain Man tells them the how and why he came to be here. It's a good story, and I don't feel so bad for eavesdropping. And then it seems the conversation has reached the end of its string. Nothing else to say. But one of the couple pipes up. We love it here. Could imagine living here. What does real estate cost in the area? Do you know of any that's available? I lean back to better hear how Mountain Man would answer. How does anyone answer such a question? I've been asked the same often regarding our little wedge of paradise, and I never know what to say. After the longest silence, he tells them gently, yes, land's available. Anything's available for a price. But if you come here, there'll be less of the valley for me. You seem perfectly nice, but do you see what I'm saying? My wife Janet glances over, her time-to-go look. We've eaten and drunk our fill, but it's not that. We spent the longest day of the year in this lovely place, and it has worked its spell, our long, dark winter seeming far behind us now. But the tight circle of hours we've been here, maybe even that small amount is too much for this tired valley. We didn't leave trash or graffiti in our wake. We covered our tracks pretty well. But something's lost. There always is. That's what works, little by little, until one day there's nothing left for the place to give, until it's the same place in name only, the magic going out like a guttering candle that's finally extinguished for good. And the truth of that, quite literally, hits home when I suddenly miss the trees of our forest more than I can say. We settle up the tab, leave a tip but not a dollar bill to tack up over the bar. It's dark outside. Finally dark. Inside the car, the dogs eagerly admit us back into the fold. It occurs to me that everybody had it wrong, warning us about bringing the dogs up here. It's we who shouldn't be in this country. The yak might need many things, but more people aren't one of those. We point the car toward the wild place that we call home, follow the picket fence of for sale signs out. We stop briefly at the curve near Hell Roaring Road. I take in hand the granite river rocks that I plucked from our creek back home, deposit them at the base of a tree. If we're lucky, nobody will ever know we were here. Roy Parvin, Yak Valley, June 1998.
Roy Parvin, you mentioned in your reading placing stones from an area of near a creek in near your home, placing those stones in the Yaak Valley. Why did you do that?
So I really felt like I should bring some sort of gift. I think when you go to a wild place like the Yaak Valley, you're sort of like a guest or an uninvited guest crashing a party. And so I felt I had to bring some sort of offering.
You write that the small amount of hours that you spent in the Yaak may, as you put it, may have been too much, and that one day the Yaak may not have anything left to give. And it almost sounds like you believe that when the land and people interact, the land is the loser.
I think so. I think that there's some kind of right equation for every kind of landscape about the people-to-land ratio. What I felt when I visited the Yaak was that here's a very closed, small society that lives here for a purpose. I mean, it's very hard to get there. And I just don't think that it's appropriate for tourism, really. I felt that it's very self-contained and should stay that way.
Why did you decide to go to the Yaak Valley?
I had read about the Yaak from reading Rick's work over the years, and I wanted to see this place. I live in the woods, and I thought that this is perhaps a cousin of the environment I lived in, and I went there, and it was familiar in some senses from reading Rick's work, but it was entirely new, and I realized that every wild place has its own personality. Even if there were trees growing there like there were trees in my forest, it has a completely different sense of place.
Tell me more about that. What, if you can compare where you live to the feeling that you got from the Yaak?
I live in the Redwoods, and so the forest is much, much taller, higher canopy. It rains a lot, but it tends to rain at different times of the year. When we were there during the summer, we had a thunder shower in the middle of the afternoon that was fairly torrential, and then half an hour later it was sunny. And in my part of the world, it only rains half the year, which is during the winter. So there were some certain cognates from one place to another, and yet the place was very, very new to me in what the animals there. They're grizzly bears. We have black bears, quite different kinds of animals. And so I felt a little bit of displacement when I was there.
So when you close your eyes and you think about your time in the Yaak, what's the image that comes forward?
I think of the sun shining till about 11, because we were there on the solstice, and it was just a lovely day. I felt really taken in by the people. The people in town really seemed to embrace us, and it seemed like they could sense that we came from a similar kind of wild place, and I enjoyed that. I had the feeling that I wanted to stay there longer, but I knew that we shouldn't stay there.
So you could only stay so much and tread lightly.
Well, my feeling is that the only way that we can go back is if Rick or somebody else invites us as guests, that it's off the beaten path for a reason, and it should probably stay that way.
Are there other areas of the country, of the world, that you feel similarly about?
I've been dog sledding on the North Slope of the Brooks Range in Alaska, and I felt very, very similarly that we watched the caribou migration go north after winter in April, and I very much felt like an interloper there. We treaded very, very lightly again, but I really felt like this was some sort of gift that we were being allowed to watch, but part of that gift, part of the deal was that we really couldn't stay there for very long.
So, Roy Parvin, when someone comes to your home turf, to the Redwood Forest, and visits your version of the Dirty Shame Saloon and asks, how much does land go for around here? What do you say?
I say land is increasing in price. It's probably out of your range. We've had some development in our area that we're sort of concerned about. It always scares me when doctors and lawyers move into an area where it used to be loggers. I think that's a really bad sign. So I do whatever I can to discourage any kind of growth.
You know, that reminds me. I lived in the East Village in the 80s, and it was still kind of a Ukrainian immigrant neighborhood. And I remember the guy who took over my apartment. This is in the 80s again, came to look at it, and he had on this pink Izod shirt. And I was like, oh, there goes the neighborhood. Not that I was Ukrainian or not that I was punked out, but I certainly didn't want this investment banker taking over my apartment for some reason. So.
Oh, it's true. We have these doctors moving next door that's just it's horrendous. I mean, they have no sense of living in the country at all. And it's sort of, you know, they want to colonize the country in some ways. I mean, when I mean country, I mean the wilderness.
But on the other hand, they are drawn to it. There's some kind of biophilia that's operating there.
I think there is. I think that there's a lot of romantic notions about living in the country that you know, once your pump goes and you have a head full of shampoo and you have to wait an hour for the pump to reset to get its suction back, a lot of that sort of charm goes away.
Hey, so maybe those doctors will only last, you know, a winter.
That's our hope.
Roy, could you read another passage from your essay? This is where you describe where you live.
We've come from somewhere that is not altogether different than Yak. A wild place with many trees and not many roads, populated by a hardy few who've taken root under the old growth. In truth, each wild area is unique as individuals, people, and it's wrong to lump them in a single category. However, I do detect a similar type of earth blood coursing through such places, places that are big and muscular in their rawness, and yet are paradoxically fragile as a china cup, places that have given and given in terms of timber and ore and should be simply allowed to rest. Pulling in the valley this morning, we saw the clear cuts that stud these hillsides standing out like a shaved head. The Yak looks tired of being dug out and cut down. The place from where we've come, I protect it with a fierceness that extends down to its name, the not altogether unreasonable fear that whenever I utter it to someone from the outside world, something gets subtracted, lost forever. That we shouldn't be here in the Yak does not escape me. We try to walk as quietly as possible despite the clatter of the soda pop can. I try to convince myself we're exchange students from one wild place to another.
Roy Parvin is a writer who lives in the woods of Northern California. Thanks for speaking with me today.
Thank you.